Well, fill out a warranty card, sign up for a rewards program, apply for a marriage license, and somewhere there's a company compiling that information you provided for profit, whether it's a retailer looking to target its advertising or a data mining business looking to sell aggregated information on you. Many of the personal details of your life are no longer private. In his new book, What Stays in Vegas, The World of Personal Data, Lifeblood of Big Business and the End of Privacy as We Know It, Adam Tanner warns that we shouldn't be as worried about the NSA collecting data as much as we should corporate America. Adam Tanner will speak on the subject tonight at 6:30 at the Kansas City Public Library, the Central Branch, 14 West 10th Street downtown. And Adam, welcome to Up to Date. So good to have you.
Thanks for having me here.
Well, Las Vegas figures prominently in this book, not just for the title, but for the case study you use throughout the book to prove that what happens in Vegas, or anywhere for that matter, really no longer stays in Vegas. The story you use to illustrate the depth of personal data collection is that of the Caesars casino empire, which, by the way, includes Harrah's in North Kansas City. Why did you pick that company?
Well, Las Vegas is especially interesting on a couple of fronts. On public information data, which is the basis of a lot of marketing, which they build upon, in some areas, Las Vegas leads the nation. So more people are married there than anywhere else. And so those records are then gathered by marketers to market to you later on. In Las Vegas, there's more video surveillance in the private spaces than anywhere else. There might be 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 cameras in a big casino. And there's more sophistication in loyalty programs than in a lot of other industries. So that made it all an interesting story to tell. And then Harrah's is the biggest casino, or Caesars, what was called Harrah's, is the biggest casino. It has more than 50 different casinos worldwide.
How did you get access to Caesars and all its operations like that, Adam?
So at the beginning of my research, I was attending a conference in Las Vegas from the Direct Marketing Association, and I made an appointment to go see the CEO of Caesars, an interesting man called Gary Loveman.
Yeah.
Someone very different from the past bosses of
Las Vegas. I was
going to
ask you about him. Yeah.
And I laid out what I was interested in doing. I wanted to see behind the scenes and tell the human stories about how they gather data. And what are the advantages and disadvantages of that? And he agreed.
And why would he agree to something like that?
Well, he's a very different person than past bosses in Las Vegas. And if you think of old bosses in Las Vegas, names of Bugsy Siegel might come to mind, or Lefty Rosenthal, who was portrayed by Robert De Niro on the movie Casino. Gary Loveman, by contrast, is someone who studied at MIT and got a PhD in mathematics. He taught at Harvard Business School. And he was well known for this concept of lifetime value of customers. How do you keep your customers coming back year after year so that even for small purchases, you're a valuable customer over time? That work drew the attention of Harrah's and the casino business, and he became a consultant and eventually full-time employee as the marketing officer and then the CEO. Because in the casino business, there's so many different casinos you could go to. They want to keep you coming there, and the way he made the great advance in doing that was by doing a lot of collection of data about his customers.
And he gets that data how?
So you can choose whether or not to participate in his program, but it's through the loyalty program. So if you want to go and gamble anonymously, you put your cash on the table and everything is fine. But if you want those perks that come along with being a frequent customer, such as the special lounge, the nights in the hotel, maybe nightclub tickets and so on, you join the program and they'll know pretty much everything you do in the public spaces of the casino.
And they do that how?
Well, you have a loyalty card which looks much like your
debit card.
Any card, right? But you might have one for an airline. You might have one for the supermarket. And at every turn, you're entering that card into the slot machine. You're giving that card to the croupier or the dealer. You're giving it to the restaurant when you're allowing them to track you at every turn. And so they'll have a very sophisticated view of what you're doing in the casino. And you've allowed them to take that information so that you can get the perks or the rewards that come later on from being a good customer.
So most people who go to casinos want to be a member of the loyalty program.
That's right. And there is another contrast with the casino gathering of data, and that is they do keep their information without selling it to other companies. Now, a lot of the information we give up on the internet or when we make purchases or subscribe to magazines, that is sold to different companies without us really knowing or having a say about that. In the casino world, it's valuable information to them, and they keep it in Vegas, so to speak.
He doesn't share it.
He doesn't share it. because it's so valuable to him. He doesn't want his rivals buying the information and having them lured across the street in Las Vegas.
Now, he got some information from a very unlikely source, which was an older couple he encountered in the elevator at Caesars. What did they say and what was his reaction at that moment?
So this was some years back, and he was riding in Harrah's casino on the Las Vegas Strip. A couple was complaining about how terrible Las Vegas was. So Gary Loveman says to them, how's it going? What's exactly why are you thinking this way? And they said, we always lose in Las Vegas, but we play slot machines in New Jersey, in Atlantic City, and we win much more often. The slot machines are terrible here. The odds are against us. But in reality, he knew the odds were much better in Las Vegas than in Atlantic City at the time. And so he realized people couldn't tell whether slot machines were generous or loose or not. And so what he did is he ran a series of mathematical tests to see whether over the cycle of millions of spins that slot machines do today, whether people could tell. He changed the odds on two sets of machines in the casino in Las Vegas and saw whether people would instinctually go to the more generous machines or not, the luckier machines. People couldn't tell because there were just too many spins in the cycles of modern slot machines. So he changed the odds to make them more favorable to the house rather than to the player. And he credits that with bringing hundreds of millions of dollars of revenue to the company over the past years.
That's really interesting. I mean, today, you know, it seems to me all this information translates into the plastic card that Total Rewards members use throughout the casino. And what else do they get from that information? What else can they tell about somebody from that card?
So they'll know that you were last here 7 days ago. On that visit, you lost $500, but you should have statistically lost $300, so you had a really bad day. Mm-hmm. They may know that on a typical visit you'll spend up to $200, and of course, spending in the casino world means losing.
Mm-hmm.
And so they may want to make it a little more comfortable for you, and they may come over and said, "Oh, you know, how's it going? Oh, here's a pair of concert tickets to this concert, which I know you like this kind of music, or here's a steak dinner. We've got a special chef in town." So they want to make you feel good, even though you may have had a very bad streak of luck in your last visit. So with that sophistication, they can try to cater to you to make you feel good about your time at the casino.
We're talking about personal privacy with Adam Tanner. His new book, What Stays in Vegas, The World of Personal Data, Lifeblood of Big Business, and the End of Privacy as We Know It. Again, he speaks at 6:30 this evening at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library, the Central Branch, 14 West 10th Street, downtown. More information, kclibrary.org. You know, Adam, gathering information on customers and prospective customers isn't new or restricted to the current digital age. What are some of the earlier examples, you know, of gathering personal data for business purposes?
Well, there's always been public records, for example, but the information was in courthouses, and it was much harder to get that stuff and assemble it into a centralized dossier. And so what computerization has meant is that you can put all this stuff together, and you'll know where people live, what their email address is, what their phone numbers are, where they've gone to school, who their friends and associates are, whether they like certain products or not, what they do in their free time. All of this is possible through computerization. Now, the first modern-day loyalty program is 1981, American Airlines, and since then, there's been ever greater sophistication. And then you pile on stuff from the internet and social media and so on, and that's pretty extensive dossiers that exist about almost all Americans.
I mean, do most folks have any clue about in terms of how much information about themselves is sort of out there and is being sold and traded around to the extent that it is these days?
It's hard to know because many companies are rather opaque in the way they gather data and what they do with it. So privacy policies of the companies are very long and hard to figure out. And
people don't really read the fine print to know when they sign up for something what they're really giving away, do they?
That's right. And then you don't know how secure things are. We've just had an instance last week where J.P. Morgan Chase had a data breach that impacted 76 million American households. That means that someone broke into their system and stole the addresses, phone numbers, and emails of two-thirds of all American households. And that if you don't bank there, you may have an American Airlines loyalty card or United Airlines loyalty card. A lot of people have something related to Chase in their pocket. And that means that your information is then floating out there. You don't know who exactly has it.
Can you give us some examples, Adam, of the kinds of personal information that's out there that might really begin to shock people? I mean, does it go as far as to say that folks folks can find out what websites you troll through, during the day or not?
So some of the things that I found in my research for the book, What Stays in Vegas, are that were surprising were very specific database or mailing lists for marketers that included medical conditions, for example. So you can buy a list of men who suffer from erectile dysfunction, and there's 1.7 million men on that list, and it costs $85 per 1,000 names, and that's name, address, perhaps email, and phone number.
That's just shocking to me. And then, that just takes my breath away.
And then you could buy, or alternatively, you could have diabetes, or you could have people with mental health conditions or so on. There are lists of high school students who are gay. So a lot of this information is gathered and used for specific marketing purposes.
Now, wait, let me slow you down. So how would somebody find out if I'm on a list for erectile dysfunction? How would people find that out?
Well, this is an interesting question. I found this list going to a direct marketing association meeting or annual convention. And I was at the table there and I said to them, this is really interesting. Tell me how you got this information. And they said, these men, they've volunteered this information to us.
Wow.
And I was thinking, 1.7 million men volunteering this information. It's hard to believe that that actually happens. So I proposed to them, let me buy 1,000 names and I'll contact these men and I'll ask them the following questions.
Yes.
I'll ask them.
A, I know what you're going to ask, yeah.
But I said, A, have you received useful marketing information based on being on this list? And B, did you know that you were on this list? And the company told me, well, that would be an immoral use of our information.
That's not fair.
Yeah. So in other words, it's a lot of these companies are fairly obscure as to who they are and what they do. And much of my book is trying to shine the light on their practices so we have a sense who's gathering the information and what are the impacts, good and bad, that happen for us as consumers.
You know, one of the pieces of information that really floored me is the extent to which that pharmacies in this country give away their information. And you write this in the book, Adam, and again, this just took my breath away. Nearly all of the country's 60,000 pharmacies send out details of each transaction to companies that compile and analyze that information to resell to others. The data include age and gender of the patient, the doctor's name, address, and contact details, and details about the prescription. Now, doesn't that violate HIPAA or some sort of federal rule out there that everyone's so racked up about privacy when it comes to healthcare? I couldn't believe that when I read that.
Well, you don't know it, but your health, there is an active trade, a multi-billion-dollar trade in your healthcare data. Now, your name is stripped out and your exact address is, but there'll be all or part of your zip code, there'll be your age, and then they'll link it with some sophistication with other prescriptions, with blood tests, with hospital exit records, other thing that you've done over time. Now, this is done largely for marketing purposes. Again, it's anonymized data. The problem, and I'm looking at this now really for book number two because it's such a complicated topic. The problem is that as data analysis becomes more sophisticated, if you have a lot of information over time about us as patients, it may be possible to re-identify them. And I have a little bit of an experiment that I do in the book where I re-identify three people by their medical records and then call them up and talk to them about it. And that's certainly an uncomfortable feeling that you don't want to be in. So I think it's a topic worthy of discussion.
But again, pharmacies are selling this information. That's the bottom line.
Right. So if you go to the pharmacy and CVS or Walgreens or others, often and you say, are you selling my information? They'll respond in the way such as follows. We completely abide by the law of the United States, or we follow HIPAA, or no need to worry about this, or I don't know. Because the practice is done kind of on a corporate level. So your individual pharmacist is not in on this trade. It's something, you know, that's done on a big scale.
And again, so if you ask them not to do it, you aren't going to get much of a response here.
So they'll say your information is anonymized, which means that you have no say. It's sort of like kryptonite, which is lethal to Superman. But if you put it in a box, which is anonymization for data, then it's protected. My issue that I'm looking at now is the box breakable? Could our data be, our medical data, be re-identified and thus cause potential damage to us? But as I mentioned before, there are still these lists that are out there, like these medical ailments lists that are sold by data brokers that are specifically named individuals. So you can buy the mental health people or people who suffer from epilepsy by name, address, phone number, and email and send them direct marketing offers. So there's two different kinds of medical information that can be out there.
Yeah. Well, let's do this. I'm going to put out our phone number here. We're having some technical issues here in the studio this morning, but I think we can still take calls. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Your questions about the privacy, the safety of the data that concerns your life every day, day in and day out, 816-235-2888, or you can send us a tweet at KCUR up to date. Again, what are you hearing from average folks out there in terms of their reaction to what you're reporting here, Adam?
Well, I mean, a lot of people feel a sense of frustration that companies are not clear about what they're doing. Now, on one hand, a lot of these developments have been great and have helped our lives immensely in the internet era. So the fact that we can use a cell phone to find directions and all those kinds of things are fantastic.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I've detected a strain of people being concerned about things going too far. And I think to some extent, it's like the development of automobiles or factories and so on. In the beginning, automobiles are a tremendous invention that has changed our lives fundamentally, but they didn't have seatbelts. And then you had lap seatbelts, and then you had three-point seatbelts, and then you had airbags and so on. And it took a lot of deaths and suffering before those security measures were put in place. And I think when it comes to personal data, even though you have good people with good intentions working in these businesses and in marketing, there may be unintended side effects. And I think some people see that. And that's what I think is worthy of talking
about. But do they have good intentions, or are you cutting them a little bit too much slack here?
Well, I mean, their intention is to market widely. I mean, people don't want – the overwhelming bulk of people, with some exceptions, don't want to cause humiliation or harm by using your personal data. They want to sell you things. Now, the exceptions are businesses such as mugshot.
Yeah, but even that is crossing a line, it seems to me, because people didn't intend for that to happen, Adam.
Yes. Well, what I'm encouraging people to do is give thought to what data they share and whether they want to share data as freely as they have. Now, there may be people who are completely open and they're fine with sharing that data. That's fine with me if they've given thought to the process and where their data goes. There may be others who want to take more privacy protections. And in my book, I have a whole appendix on what you can do to be more private so that your data is not always being gathered at every turn.
Well, let's walk down that road for a minute, because people are going to be who are listening to this are going to be wondering right now, what can they do? Can they go to CVS and say, take me off your list? Or what can they do?
Well, so for example, I'm with a woman today from the library, the Kansas City Library, who is pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
And she's being constantly bombarded by advertising on the internet. They figured it out. And there's a lot of money to be made off of her because she has to buy cribs and all this other kind of stuff. Now, if she doesn't like the fact that she's being targeted in that way, she can use a different internet browser, or she can use something called a VPN, a virtual private network, where it will mask what her home address is of her computer. So it won't be sending her those ads.
Right, but that means you got to know some stuff about computers, right?
Unfortunately, to boost your privacy, given that legislation has lagged behind developments, it's probably the best thing in the current atmosphere. I mean, I think you'll just find it easier to take these steps if you care. I mean, there's other things you can do using one-time email addresses for different companies, so that you might have one for a supermarket, or another for a business, a third for an airline, and they'll all bounce to your main address. And if you start getting too many emails from any one company, you can just shut off that one industry or business-specific one. So yes, it's more of a hassle. It takes more work to boost your privacy, but if you care about it, it's worth doing.
So it means actively taking a role and getting out there and being active and fighting this thing is what you're talking about.
In essence, yes. Or if you think even there was Jennifer Lawrence and other actresses who saw their information that was spilled out of their own private cloud servers into the internet, had they encrypted that information on their computer, it might have been much more secure when they put it up into the cloud. And so it's true. It takes more of an effort. It would be nice if you didn't have to do anything and you had those protections. But given what we have right now in our society, of course, different countries have different rules. But given what we have in the United States now, you do have to do something if you care about these issues.
How concerned are you about your personal privacy? That's our topic today. We're visiting again with Adam Tanner about his new book, What Stays in Vegas, The World of Personal Data, Lifeblood of Big Business and the End of Privacy as We Know It. Again, he speaks at the Public Library this evening at 6:30, the Kansas City, Missouri, the Central Branch, 14 West 10th Street. To grab a seat, kclibrary.org. How concerned are you about your personal property? Tweet us at KCUR up to date. You know, it was shocking for me to learn too, Adam, that for a monthly fee, many cities regularly send updated information on you know, license applications and other businesses conducted throughout a city's, you know, city's clerk's office to these companies that compile the information. Why must cities respond to these requests for information? What's happening out there?
So, I mean, traditionally, these documents are public documents because we want our government to be accountable as to what they're doing. And so things such as mugshots are sort of a way to being accountable. Who are you arresting on the behalf of society, right? I mean, of course, you think of secret police states where people are arrested and you never know who's arrested. So the logic is quite sound behind why you want the government to be accountable. But what's happened in the computer era is that you then add up all these documents into one dossier held by private companies, and then you know quite a bit about any individual.
And so they have to give it up is what you're saying. The cities don't have any choice here.
They have, but there's been some interesting legislation even in the last year or two. There's a chapter in my book about mugshot websites where companies have taken mugshots, put them on the internet, and there's 12 or 14 million Americans that are arrested every year. They code them in a way that the photo comes out very prominently, and then they say, oh, if you want, you can remove this photo for $100. So it's not extortion. They've put up the photo on the internet in a way that can cause humiliation or embarrassment, giving you the chance to take it down later. But some some states have since, in the last year or so, acted and said, no, you can't do this kind of business. You can't use mugshots and then take money to take them off the internet. So there is some response of how public documents are being handled, and it's up to each state and jurisdiction to do so.
I would think folks who are listening to this would be becoming very concerned about exactly how much material is out there. I mean, the sheer amount of data that can be assembled on any one person just struck me as so staggering. You write in the book about Axiom. Am I saying that right? A company
Yes.
that makes most of its money by supplementing personal data collected by its client companies. Here's a partial list of sources it mines for data. Get this. Public records, warranty cards, online surveys about hobbies and lifestyle information, magazine publishers, retailers, credit card header data, non-financial info at the top of a credit report that could have Social Security numbers on it. And they'll just sell this to just about anybody, right?
Well, they sell it to marketers, again, to target marketing. But there's an interesting twist with Axiom, which is one of the perhaps the very biggest of these data brokers that most of Americans have not heard of. A year ago, they decided to release to make individual consumers aware of what their files are if they want to look them up. So if you're curious, what does Axiom know about me? You can go to a site called aboutthedata.com, and that's free. You enter some information such as your Social Security number and name, which they already have.
I was going to say give away more information here.
But they already have it, so
yeah.
They're just confirming that it's you. And then you'll see what profile they have on you. Do they know that you like fishing? Do they know what sports team you like? Do they know that you have two children? The people that I've talked to have found that they know quite a bit, but there's still strange errors in it because these data files are not perfect. So they may think that you have three children when you have two. They may think that you're an avid hunter, but you may never have touched a gun, but they may know 80% of the stuff that's correct. And for marketing purposes, that's fine.
What if the information is wrong and you're on some list that would be very inaccurate? You know, a pornography kind of situation is what I'm thinking about. How can you seek redress for something like that?
Well, that Axiom site I mentioned allows you to correct your file if you want. Now, you mentioned about pornography. If you buy something from a company called Adam and Eve, which sells adult products, films and devices and so on, they sell those mailing lists to others. And it's written somewhere in the fine print that they will be doing that. And I think at that point, you actually have made the purchase. So it's hard to get off the list, and you may be then bombarded with related offers. So the best thing to do is to think before you make that purchase. And there may be sensitive purchases that you want to go in and make your sale in cash rather than giving away your information to get that product.
And there are also websites that allow me or anybody willing to pay a fee to look at the personal data of people, you know, around me, I guess. Tell us about those.
So these are people lookup sites. And so you can enter in and see whether they have criminal records, see where they live, their phone numbers, and so on. And this has been a big growth business in recent years. There's a whole chapter in the book about some of these companies which are fairly secret about who they are. And in one case, there's a company that I found was using a fake spokesperson. They created an entire fictitious person to speak on behalf of the company. And there's a long sort of R-rated story that leads to how I found this person who had nothing to do with the company, whose image was used for this company on a Yelp page. So there's a lot of strange tales that are happening because it's a bit of Wild West in how our personal data is used. And a lot of this stuff is unregulated in many aspects of the economy today.
But again, you could go up and down your block, you're saying, these days and find out all kinds of stuff about your neighbors that maybe you didn't know before.
That's right. Now, of course, you think about the olden days, you would probably know a lot about your neighbors just from gossiping in the neighborhood, but it wouldn't be forever entered into a file that anyone from anywhere could look up. And that's what's different about the aggregation or having a centralized dossier. Mm.
Again, how accurate, just generally speaking, is the information that's out there, would you say, just based on what you've taken a look at?
I mean, I think a lot of it is accurate, but the problem is when you try to unravel these individual dossiers, it's sort of like Cheese Whiz, which consists of something like 20 different ingredients gobbled into one giant ball, none of which are cheese in the case of Cheese Whiz. But but for the individual ingredients, once errors enter in, it's hard for them to draw back and say, oh, we've gotten some mistaken information from here. And so there are errors in the files, but they're pretty accurate, especially as regards figuring out who to market to.
And ultimately, Adam, the potential dangers if this collection of personal data continues to go unchecked, the potential dangers and pitfalls would be what?
So, we're seeing this just recently. So you have hackers breaking into the files at JP Morgan Chase, and apparently they tried to get into other financial files. I mean, if you're working as a prison guard or as a judge, or if you're a battered woman or all sorts of different professions where you don't want people knowing where you live or your contact details, that could be something. Even this minimal hacking, which didn't reveal financial data the other day, that could be something that makes you feel uncomfortable or could potentially put you at danger. In some of the cases I've mentioned, such as these mugshot websites, they certainly also put you in a disadvantageous position. Now, again, a lot of the internet stuff is great, and I wanted to present all these different sides. Why are the businesses doing it? What are the advantages? But there is this darker side that's more unregulated, and I think those are things that we need to give thought to and perhaps some protections against in the future.
Well, Adam Tanner's new book again, What Stays in Vegas, The World of Personal Data, Lifeblood of Big Business and the End of Privacy as We Know It. It really is the end of privacy as we know it, isn't it?
Yes.
Again, he speaks this evening at 6:30 at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library, the Central Branch, 14 West 10th Street. Go to kclibrary.org for more information. What a pleasure to have you here.
Thanks
so much.
Thanks very much for having me.